Fulwell 73 Productions logo floats onto screen. Fade to black. Neon Films.
Long time. I should have thought this.
An official Soviet government news agency has reported that a UFO landed recently near Moscow, complete with 10-foot-tall aliens from space. Some people in Britain are convinced that UFOs are causing strange new patterns on English farmland.
The origin of the strange pattern in fields is something of a mystery.
Well, I thought it was something from outer space. There's nothing up on Stockbridge Down otherwise.
Crop circles. Yella tarabadi mystery ga migilina adbhutamaina drishyalu.
That's the precise center of the circle, where the energies are actually still imploding.
And no one knows who or what is causing them.
This morning, we now know the secret of who created it and why.
Some of these crop circles were the work of an underground dance band, the KLF, who've pulled a string of bizarre media stunts, which have had everyone scratching their heads.
The idea was to spread so much chaos and confusion that nobody would know what on earth was true.
So where did the idea come from?
Bill.
In big rooms, put a plank across the bottom of the room, tape it all up, and the whole thing got completely out of hand in our heads. And when they asked us, well, did you do it? I had to say, well, I don't know.
A Fulwell 73 and Neon Films production in association with Naughty Sleep, directed by Chris Atkins.
So we never set out at all to be this global, international, multi-successful dance, pop, crossover, whatever it was. That was never part of the game plan. KLF is gonna rock you.
By 1992, the KLF were the hottest band on the planet. Then with the music world in their hands, they vanished.
Ladies and gentlemen, the KLF has now left the building.
A bit further down. Okay, that's it, I'll do.
For the foreseeable future, there will be no further record releases from the KLF and any other past, present and future name attached to our activities. As of now, all our past releases are deleted.
We've deleted it for the rest of our lives. That's what you can't get from iTunes. You can't buy CDs.
For years, the band have refused to talk about it.
I can't talk about any of these things. I'm not in a position to. I couldn't even start to.
But now, using previously unheard tapes,
you can get into this whole area where it's pretty black. It's really heavy for me and Bill to deal with.
We can finally tell the whole story.
You know, but just where'd you start?
Show title, Who Killed the KLF?
I've always loved out-and-out pop music.
A young boy watches the Beatles perform on TV.
The greatest piece of art that had been made in the 20th century was Strawberry Fields Forever by the Beatles. And part of the reason why I thought it was the greatest piece of art was that we could all buy it for... When I first bought it, it had been 7 and 6 pence. I loved everything by the Beatles. It just dragged you in and dragged you under and took you places you'd never been before and opened up the whole idea that pop music could be all sorts of things. The cliché is, I went to Liverpool Art School because John Lennon went there.
Liverpool, 1977.
We used to all hang around a club called Eric's in Liverpool. And it was seeing The Clash on the 5th of May, 1977. At Eric's, It was after that we decided, let's form a band.
Big in Japan.
I used to hang around. Old hands.
At various times, Ian Brody, Holly Johnson, Budgie, who went on to Susie and the Banshees, Jane Casey, Dave Balfe, keyboard player with Teardrop Explodes, and Bill Drummond. Well, just over a year later, we'd knocked the band on the head. I was old enough to hire a van. That's about the only qualifications I had. I just turned to friends, people we knew around us, said, do you want to put a record out? We're starting a record label. We didn't get involved with them, thinking, these are great bands. These were just the only people we knew. And it was Echo and the Bunnymen and the Teardrop Explodes. And then I was forced into the position of being the manager. The idea of being a manager, no idea at all. I was trying to push the Bunnymen in the only ways that I could.
The seed sown for what would happen much later with the KLF, it's to do with building the myth. And the one thing Bill has always done is be brilliant at building a myth.
I was more into the mystery that surrounds a band, or the tensions.
Bill's idea of managing was he got them to do tours of the Orkney Islands, and he plotted the tour route by drawing the ears of a bunny on a map, and they followed that route.
I mean, I can look back now, I can see these gross mistakes I made.
Most managers want to make money and think their job is to count up the dirty tenors at the end of the concert. But part of his practice is to just critique everything, especially what he does.
I can look back across the plain and over there, pop music, a land in a sorry state. It's the music! The music! The music is spiritually bankrupt!
In 1986, I decided to get out of the music business altogether. I was just so tired of the traditional song, the well-crafted song. For me, it had become so boring, so lame, so tired. I'd begun to hate everything about it. First day of 1987, I thought, I'm going to make a hip-hop record. I knew Jimmy. I knew he was a like spirit. So I phoned them up that day. I said, let's form a band called the Justified Ancients of Moomoo. And he knew exactly where I was coming from.
They had this almost uncanny sense of telepathy with each other from the start. It was almost like they knew what the other was thinking. And creatively, were absolutely a 50-50 partnership.
Bill just phoned up out of the blue. Said he got this idea for a record that was very interesting. I'd just been in this terrible pop band. Brilliant.
Now we've got our next live group, who are made up of June, who's the vocalist, who used to be a singer on the QE2, and Jimmy on guitar, who used to be an illustrator for Tolkien posters.
One poster which I designed in the early 70s was the best-selling poster in the world for about 8 years.
So with that esoteric lineup, we've got the fantastic, brilliant.
The music we'd made as a band was just a total mess. We couldn't really write a pop song. We couldn't really write any kind of song.
Jimmy was in this band called Brilliant. We were being produced by Pete Waterman.
Pete Waterman was behind 13 number one singles and over 100 top 40 hits, and launched the careers of Kylie Minogue and Rick Astley.
I advise everybody to try and be a pop star, because it's a wonderful existence. 1 minute you're doing an interview, 20 minutes later you're on a plane to New York, 24 hours later you're back in the studio.
Sitting there, in the back was a young Jimmy Courtney.
Because I'd turn up at the studio with my guitar, going, well, we did the guitar last night.
He and Youth were told on day one they were surplus to requirements, they wouldn't be playing a note on the record.
I mean, he's right. I mean, it just sounded awful before, and we had to do something about it.
So me and Youth sat there watching them make these records and producing. We learned a hell of a lot.
So an awful lot of what happened with the KLF was really, really informed and educated by Pete Waterman.
Stock, Aitken and Waterman Hit Factory. It was very much about success. It was about hit after hit after hit. This was the spirit of the age. The 80s was just money. That was the answer. Everything, guiding principle, was money. And if there's one thing you say about Bill and Jimmy, is they weren't doing it for the money.
Hello.
I'm Bill Drummond. I sometimes call myself King Boy D.
And
I'm Rockman, and that's what I'm going to be called today.
And we're the Justified Agents of Lulu.
We'd come across samplers. We wanted to dump the whole history of pop music and starting again by just sampling things and building things up like that. That was incredibly exciting.
Just nicked whatever they liked. Used it how they liked.
We didn't think that anybody would take notice of us. We thought it was going to be completely underground.
Voice of James Brown, former journalist of Sounds and NME.
I was walking into Sounds, which was a weekly music paper, and on the way I saw a big poster campaign for Today newspaper. There was this big graffitied sticker that said Shag Times. And I got into the Sounds office. There's always envelopes of records for journalists there. And one I opened, it's just a white label, and it had a photograph of that very poster. I took the record home and I listened to it and I thought it was great. I took it back in the next day on the Wednesday and said, this is the single of the week. And there was this almighty row because the reviews editor, who was quite close-minded, said, you can't have a single of the week that people can't buy.
So it wasn't in shops?
No, it didn't even have a label on. But he had a mixture of a Vietnamese guy singing, some nursery rhyme, the MC5 shouting, what the fuck is going on?
What the fuck is going on?
Nowadays, sampling and cut-ups are totally commonplace. In those days, the idea of taking somebody else's song, and not only was it somebody else's song, it was the Beatles and ABBA. Two best-selling pop artists of the 60s and the 70s. So we did the interview, and we put them on the cover.
The Justified Agents of Moo Moo came onto the scene in 1987, causing a stir straight away with their illegal use of other people's music.
Bill never does things by halves. If he is going to start on something, then he is going to carry it through to its illogical conclusion. You could see that they were going to get into trouble for that. That's not necessarily a good enough reason for not doing anything.
The track that caused all the problem was The Queen and I. Which was totally based on ABBA's song, Dancing Queen. We just mixed their track in and out.
It was more the original sample than their thing. We weren't taking a little bit of it, but playing the record and occasionally shouting over it. Then the lawyers were down on them like a ton of bricks.
And they were completely horrified with what we'd done. They wanted it destroyed straight away. Our solicitor was saying, you're going to spend $20,000 trying to fight this in court and you're going to lose. I just felt artistically there was no difference to what they were doing to what we were doing. But their legal people would have none of it.
They said we're going to go to Sweden and talk to ABBA because ABBA were going to stop us bringing the record out. So we went in Jimmy's police car.
The KLF duo walked through the boat, one holding a briefcase.
So we got the boat over. And with all the remaining copies of our album with us that we were supposed to destroy.
And they were throwing the records into the sea. I think they used that later on an album. You just picture this going off into the wake. Jimmy just looked like Jimmy still looks like, straggly hair, anorak, grimy jeans, walking boots. Bill was dressed sort of like a Scottish laird. It took a day to get there, and that's the first time the KLF ever played live. They did karaoke on the stage, and they won a massive Toblerone. We drove through the night to Stockholm, and we were just playing ABBA all the way there.
We got there at 3 a.m. in the morning, and obviously, you know, we were being totally stupid.
You know, ABBA lived in Henley-on-Thames, and had done for many years. It was 1 a.m. 1 a.m. eternal in Stockholm. We were only a receptionist, I mean, Waterloo.
But we knew they wouldn't meet us, but we wanted to make that statement. We had the gold album for sales in excess of zero copies of our album.
And I saw this quite rotund blonde prostitute who looked like a strange version of Agnetha. And I said, why don't you just give it to her?
I didn't think it was our thing to liberate the grooves, but I just wanted to state the case that what we were doing was artistically right. We built a huge funeral pyre of all our albums and set them on fire.
So I woke up in the back of the car and we were in the middle of a cornfield. So they just burnt a load of records in a field. Looked good for a photo shoot.
The spectacle, the drama, it was all about confrontation.
The Justified Ancients of Mumu are the band everyone is talking about. But who on earth are they? Where did the Justified Ancients of Mumu come from?
The Eye of Providence symbol on a dollar bill.
The Justified Ancients of Mumu were one of the various warring imaginary cults that were mentioned in the Illuminatus trilogy. A fiction had infected Bill's consciousness and life.
Before Sweden, before Big in Japan, and before all these things, Bill had had his mind blown by a book called The Illuminatus Trilogy. And this book was kind of like the sacred text of an underground 1960s religion called Discordianism. Discordianism goes back to a meeting between two friends in the 1950s in a bowling alley. This was Greg Hill and Kerry Thornley, and they used to meet to drink beer and try and work out why the world didn't make any sense.
And we were discussing philosophy, and we were talking about order and chaos. My theory was that order emerged from chaos. Greg's theory was that order was projected on the universe, that it didn't exist at all. And I said, well, you know, what we need is not so much an explanation for order, but what the world needs is an explanation for chaos. At that point, we decided to start a religion, and thus Discordianism was born. I'm interested in finding some technique by which great masses of people can be broken out of their authoritarian conditioning all at once.
A lot of what the Discordians did was called Operation Mindfuck. They would write letters to magazines with completely ludicrous positions in.
There are the same number of letters in Lincoln as there are in Kennedy, and both were assassinated by men with middle names and replaced by Johnsons.
The idea was to spread so much chaos and confusion that nobody would know what on earth was true. And this was the tradition that Bill and Jimmy picked up on.
Well, we nicked a lot of stuff, obviously, from Illuminati. It was just there, waiting to be used.
They discovered Discordianism through the core text of that religion, which was the Illuminatus trilogy.
The Illuminatus books were a total send-up of sci-fi and conspiracy fiction. They weave their way through all kinds of surreal fantasies and conspiracies.
I, Markov Chaney, discovered another hidden joke in my name.
Ken Campbell, already a well-established author and director, started an outfit specifically to perform a freewheeling adaptation of the novels.
And Santana's troops losing all fear because they was high on Rosa Maria.
The plays were a great success, despite the fact that the first performance lasted 12 hours. I went along there to find out what the Illuminati are.
But there may be the people behind the scenes who are really running things.
I mean, it would seem a bit unlikely that Nixon was running things exactly, you know what I mean?
By a strange coincidence, the stage manager of the Illuminatus production was a young Bill Drummond.
Bill thought it might be a good idea if he actually read the books that it was based upon. By the time he got to halfway through the first book, he'd already read enough. Ken Campbell sent him out for a tube of Araldite, and Bill never came back. He wanted to actually go out into the world and be this book.
Taking on the name Justified Ancients of Mumu meant they were taking on the name Forces of Chaos, who are at war with the music industry. So that was right there at the start.
Last year, we realised the time had come in the history of pop music where anybody, well, we thought anyway, anybody could have a number one. We could just reach out and grab it, so we thought we'd have one.
We went into the studio on a Monday thinking we were going to make a house track, you know, regular underground dance house track using a bit of the Doctor Who theme tune. We realised it was in triplet time, and you can't have house tracks in triplet time. The only beat that we'd work with it was the glitter beat.
That track took itself over, really. It's like an out of control lorry.
Doctor Who, hey, the TARDIS, Doctor Who, hey.
And we just went for the lowest common denominator.
A couple of days into it, we realised how terrible it was.
By Tuesday evening, we realised we had a number one.
And we have a brand new number one on Top of the Box this week. Is it a bird? Is it a plane? There's a car. Hear the Time Lords.
The current number one song on the pop charts this week is allegedly the brainchild of an American police car called Ford Time Lord.
He sits in the studio and tells us what he wants and we actually do it for him.
The song was all my idea and we made a great record.
My earliest memory was wanting to be on Top of the Pops. Then finally I was on and was at number one. Best thing. It only lasted for a week, then it was all over. It just dissipated in front of us.
I think most people thought that it was just a stupid record that everybody hated, which on one level it was, you know.
Doctor and the TARDIS had shown how easy it was to have a number one.
All you need to get to number one is this pile of junk. Get three bits of other songs and stick them together with a bit of sellotape.
So the next step was to lift the curtain and show everyone else how to do it.
This is the new thing from the cranial recesses of Bill Drummond, the manual How to Have a Number One the Easy Way.
Get this book, we guarantee within 3 months you will have a number one. You'll be there on Top of the Pops, the pole position.
Every step of the way, it's all this stuff, how money.
If you don't get a number one, we will refund the price of the book.
Because it is cynical, funny, and scientific at the same time.
All we're talking about is having a number one.
That's
feeling,
all.
You know, getting to the top of the castle, just even if it's only for 1 week like we did, you know, they can look down at the rest and think, we've done it, we've made it.
The book was saying, if you want a number one single, forget about a band. But really what that book was about was saying, if you want to do something, don't wait to be given permission, just go ahead and do it. That's up to you. Don't take no for an answer from anybody. Don't let anybody say, I'm afraid you're not good enough, you haven't passed the test.
There was a record that came out last year by Edelweiss. And they came to see us, they had this whole idea of using yodeling music and mixing up with hip-hop. They were sweet boys, but we just thought, they're offspring, they don't stand a chance. And we said, well, we've just written this book. Follow the instructions in the book and you'll have yourself a number one, thinking that's the last we'll ever hear from them. 5 weeks later, they phoned us again to say they were now number one. And sold 5 million copies.
In their music video, a man falls from a building. Sierra Nevada, Spain, 1988.
In 1988, when we had the Time Lords record and we had all this money coming in from all over the world, we went out to Spain, to the Sierra Nevada region, which is where they make all the spaghetti westerns. We thought, that's it. What's the greatest folly that every rock star gets involved in? Filmmaking. So we wanted to go and make our own film.
This is the set of the Time Lords movie. Now, the working titles for that today are The White Room, The Liberation Loophole, or maybe Altering the Keystone Cops. Anyway, I'm going to be in the movie. OK, come with me. Bill Drummond, you're one of the grooviest men in London. What's going on here, Bill?
Well, this is our film. This is the party at the beginning of our film.
You've actually made this with the money you've made from the
Time Lords record, yeah.
Is there a part maybe for the Lance and George Scotsman in this film?
It depends how this programme comes out. Currently, if it comes out really well for us, we might give you a job.
And action!
Film roll countdown.
We stupidly thought we could make a road movie without a script or without a story. We thought, well, we'll just go to Spain in the car and just film what happens. So of course we went there and nothing happened. It just rained. We came back with hundreds of hours of really boring footage. Me and Bill were driving in the car that way, then over a hill. It's just tedious, terrible, terrible disaster of a movie.
They've wasted $1 million on the White Room film.
It was never released.
Never released, never properly finished.
It was a financial disaster. They were broke, they were hungry, they didn't really know what it was they were supposed to be doing next. But the world caught up with them. Suddenly, their time had come.
A house party, a young woman enjoys the music by dancing energetically and singing with a can in her hand.
Acid house parties came on the scene in the summer of 1988. At first attracting hundreds, now 10,000 can gather to dance all night.
When the rave started coming, they started taking ecstasy and they realised there was a new home for them.
And it was a type of music that was really exciting me. We wanted to make something that was more pure dance music. Without any reference points, without any nod to the history of rock and roll.
Voice of Carl Cox, DJ and producer.
It was probably the best intro record you'd ever hear in your life. Paul Oakenfold used to play that at the Heaven Club in the early days. That would be the first record you would start with. The lasers would go up, the smoke would go up, the sound would go louder. Then What Time Is Love would come on.
What time is love? What time is love? What time is love? What time is love?
Trying to get into a rave that was trying to be shut down by the cops. All the whole excitement of it all. I mean, we did have quite a lot of equipment that we'd try and get into these places. Half the time you can never get a band, let alone get yourselves there. Always start off with the best intention. And attempt to play live. Samplers all ready to go, sequences. But we were too out of it on the track to be able to see anything. And I just turned the DAT on. And we just played the track, which would sound much better anyway. Everybody was so out of it, nobody even cared. Nobody was looking at the stage. Still at that point where people were just sort of dancing around. Focus wasn't on the group, it was on the music. It was just on for the moment. It just worked in that moment.
Officially, it stood for nothing. They would say a different thing every time. Copyright Liberation Front. Kings of Low Frequencies. King Lucifer Forever. Is in the tradition of Discordians, they kept changing their names. It was just keeping the spirit alive and renaming it chaotic.
We all know
It's a zeitgeist thing as well. The mistake most artists make, they think it's them that's the great ones. In actual fact, they're just part of something. They're just part of a thing that's happening at a certain time.
That's the seeds for what the KLF turned into.
Okay, everybody, lie down on the floor and keep calm.
This is KLF, take land.
They made records that people really loved then. And those records, they had character at a time when people making music didn't have character. They were just like DJs or studio engineers. And these two guys had a tremendous amount of character and ability to project it.
And number five with What Time Is Love, a number two with Last Train to Trance Central, a number one with 3 AM Eternal, and another number two with The White Room.
You would be selling 200,000, 300,000, 400,000 copies of singles then, a week.
Peter Thompson, distribution manager, number one in Finland, number two in Sweden, number two in Norway, and counting.
6 million singles and 2 million albums in the end.
The biggest selling singles band in the world this year is the KLF.
They were a big band. Despite themselves.
The fact that we were both in our 30s at the start of it, so we weren't driven by that late teens, early 20s, hey, come on, girls, where are you? It wasn't fueled by any of that.
People would always say, you two have just got this in joke nobody really gets. There was never any disagreement on anything. Bubble of our own, really.
It's all done around Jimmy Scott. One of the floors was missing. That was their office, that was their recording studio, that was their headquarters, and they had raves there. And that's where a lot of the boxes of records got delivered.
It was our own record label. We had no manager. We were in complete control. And those are all things that I've aspired to all along.
There was two industries then. There was us and them, the majors. And KLF were very much part of us.
Voice of Nick Queller, writer, programmer and producer.
It was very, very intense. You know, the whole thing was just going every day, you know, that was it. It was that's what you did for a few years. I mean, we were just making, which was great.
We've got nothing constraining us. We do exactly what we want to do when we want to do it.
Everything we did was something that I can't really say, well, you mustn't do that.
Where? Outside. Which is outside?
And we were watching our Norm Wisdom movie.
It's here. It's a man overboard.
So we just recorded that. In the submarine on 3 AM. That was off Das Boot. And sometimes I'd be going to do a session somewhere and they'd go, oh, can you just pop by Olympic Studio? I'd get there and there'd be three coaches and loads of guys with sandwich bags. And I'd go in and they'd got the Red Army Choir in there. You know, we're going to do Que Sera Sera. Never any scrimping, whatever needed to be done. Two Mexicans, no problem. Phone up the Mexican embassy. Just full-on push the boundaries all the time. Then one day, I'd be in the studio. I thought, well, I wonder where they've gone. 8 hours later, they turned up. And I said, oh, where have you been? They said, oh, we've been in prison. They changed the Gulf War poster. And then the police were watching, and then they got arrested.
You've got to remember, they were promoted and built through the press. And I was driving that. And the new editor of the NME said that the way we're going to rebuild the NME is just by doing the bands that we like and that the audience likes again and again and again and again.
Clubman, the message very clearly was, if nothing's going on, make it up. So that was the brief. So every week I would just come up with something.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. This was a band. It didn't have a record deal. It didn't have a manager. So I realised that basically you could say anything. And nobody was going to know the wiser.
Is this, are you asking the question, shot now?
Yeah, this is you. The other thing as well, it's too late, I should have told you at the beginning, but when the other person's speaking, it's always best if you sort of look a little bit interested.
Does it? I mean, I can't do that.
You're like this. I'm picking your nose at one stage.
That's part of my sort of pop star rating.
The more success you get, the more calls you get from people wanting you to do this. It's all around all the radio stations, the shows, the interviews. Turns out that it's absolute rubbish. Quite early on, he decided to not do any more interviews or have anything to do with the outside world. Just cut ourselves off completely. And not say anything to anybody about anything. And that worked in our favour because it made people even more interested.
The Ocean and a Field of Sheep. Caption on screen. Isle of Jura, Scotland.
On the destination board, it just said destination, further. There was all these people, and there were journalists, music journalists, basically, from all over the world. And we sort of gradually realised that we'd all been invited. I'd been a production assistant on Steve Wright in the afternoon. The band basically got in touch with the show.
To say?
To say, be at Heathrow Airport this Saturday.
Did you know, have any inkling of what way you're going?
No idea. No idea. And you have your passport, so you go, we're probably going abroad.
And we were put on this little plane, and we were flown to Isla. I had no idea where we were, where I was, anything at all.
A large ferry arrives at a dock.
Got a ferry over to Jura. Then when we arrived in Jura, I think there was Bill and Jimmy.
Wearing military uniforms. And we all had to hand over our passports, which was stamped with the KLF logo.
I stamped my passport. I've still got it. It stopped me getting into American early.
And then I was put into a car, and it was Andy in the driver's seat, this long-haired, slightly tanned, with an earring 19-year-old. They made us all dress up, and we still didn't have a clue what was going on or why we were here. And we had to walk along the bottom of the hills on Jura. They had these four Japanese girls dressed in see-through white 90s, wafting into the sea. They burnt a wicker man.
Did this whole state pagan ceremony. Bill, he was up on a platform, dressed as this horn. Did this whole speech in a foreign language he just made up. Totally brilliant. Everybody was completely gobsmacked. Those are the sort of things that we like to do to communicate to the outside world.
I think it was just a big thank you or a big fuck you, who knows?
But they didn't say to you, oh, here's why we're doing this.
No, they never tell you why, do they? They just did it, and we enjoyed it. We enjoyed the moment.
They had a sound system up from Brixton.
The sound system was absolutely massive. There was complaints made from a different island, so yeah, they were complaining about the noise levels.
Basically, Midsummer Night rave.
A lot of people dancing for a long time, for whatever reason.
It was a quality street tin full of ecstasy being handed around. No one had a clue what it was. That was nice.
a room at the back with loud dance music and strobe lighting. White light. And you're in that room and you go, aha, this is the white room. It totally made sense.
I really love the KLF. And they were the coolest couple of dudes. And they were just doing something completely different. No one had ever done anything like that. Mix of art, music, terrorism, whatever way you want to look at it.
Mountain landscape with a deer on its own.
On the Sunday, all feeling a little bit worse for wear, we all got on the plane back to Liverpool. We would be taken to a theatre where Pee Wee Herman was playing.
And we appeared on stage during the Festival of Comedy in front of an ice cream van, just singing, "We're Justified and We're Ancient, and We Drive an Ice Cream Van." I went straight back into the studio on Monday. I put out a call on national radio, completely abusing the BBC services. If the boy I met is listening, I'd love to get in touch. He turned up on my doorstep. I eventually came back to Jura, yeah. Now I have four children. Kitty Lily Fletcher, her initials spell KLF. It's meant to be, clearly. She hates that story.
A photo of the couple sharing a kiss on their wedding day.
Obviously, we were inside there creating the stuff, so I'm not really sure what it must have looked like from the outside. A lot of people thought that maybe we did have a proper vision, but we didn't really, we were just making it up. We were just winging it day to day. And a lot of the time, we couldn't decide what to do. We would say to ourselves, what would the KLF do in a situation like this? We were always able to stand outside and say, well, there's the KLF, what would they do now? It was almost like the KLF was a made-up band, or we're managing them.
We never think of ourselves as a group. We just think of ourselves as two individuals that are working together, fulfilling our fantasies. And it's not us trying to be difficult or different. It's just the natural thing for us to do.
In general sense, and especially with Bill, he's about the initial impulse and looking after it. In the tarot, card zero in the tarot is the Fool, and that represents the initial impulse. And it's pure, and it's innocent, and it's naive.
Our best actions are those which are without lust of result, our purest actions, where you've got no objective in mind. You're just doing it because it has to be done.
The story of the KLF is a reminder that success doesn't necessarily come from doing things right. We're sort of in a culture that looks at things like the X Factor.
We are kind of taking a bit of a gamble. We've tried something a little bit different.
No, I won't! No!
That was bloody awful.
And you have to sing this song exactly as it's supposed to be sung.
I love that little quirky sound you have in your voice, but you're doing it too much.
And then they're just forgotten, because it means nothing. Whereas Bill and Jimmy, not a single decision they made would have been agreed by Simon Cowell. And doing everything right all the time is not going to do anything interesting. Jimmy and I were in a studio in South London. We were working on the track Justified and Ancient. There was somebody who had sung, and it just wasn't working out. Jimmy kind of half-jokingly said to me, what this track needs is Tammy Wynette. I made one call and then another call. And within 20 minutes, half an hour, I was actually speaking to Tammy Wynette. And within a few days, I was on the plane, landed at Nashville, get picked up by her husband in his powder blue Jag, taken to First Lady Acres, the classic big white gates that electronically open, into the house, and I hear this voice. Hey, Bill, is that you? And this is Tammy Wynette talking to me, and I was a massive fan. She's got this boudoir upstairs, and she's all being done up by her personal beautician to go to the studio that night. They had a big white grand piano, and I'm sitting there playing Justified and Ancient, and her trying to sing along, and my hands are shaking, trying to do the chords. We started recording it, and she was rubbish. And how do you tell Tammy Wynette, I'm afraid, Tammy, it's a it's not working. She'd always sung to her band. And she slows down, they all slow down. She'd never sung to machines. Obviously, that's what Jimmy and I dealt with, machines. And she just couldn't sing in time with this thing. So when I flew back home and got back with Jimmy, and I said, look, it's a complete disaster. I've failed us. But the engineer, he just got this new bit of studio gear where you could speed things up and shrink things down and stretch, and which everybody uses that now, but then... And she said, oh, we can handle that. We had to use the trickery of the studio. And within a couple of hours, we got the whole thing working and it all worked in place.
Guys, they cleaned up. They were the biggest fucking pop band at that time.
It was hundreds of thousands of pounds being paid out to the KLF on a monthly basis. They were the record company and the artist, so they were getting both shares of the pie. I reckon I wrote out my first £1 million cheque to KLF.
We were on a roll. We became so popular that virtually anything we did would be a hit. Even though we'd still be putting everything into these records, it seems like it was so easy to have a hit.
Huge amounts of money swilling around, of great pressures to deliver.
Pinewood Studios.
And I think the best things that they ever did were spectacles. Those massive, amazing videos they did.
The music video for their song What Time Is Love being filmed at Pinewood.
It's almost like the music business was their studio and they were the artists. But all their videos are quite mad. Most people making mad videos are doing it on a budget. People don't tend to spend that much money on doing something like on a classic and disturbing in some cases.
Music you are about to experience is a celebration of their founding of this great nation. What time is love? What time is love?
America, What Time Is Love? Epic video with one of the latter-day singers of Deep Purple. We got this Viking ship that had come from Monty Python shoot.
By the time we got to the end, it was all getting a bit weird. We'd been going so flat out. We're both exhausted.
There's no manager, there's no infrastructure in place to tell you what your next move should be. It meant they increasingly entered their own private psychic space.
And there was a much, much darker side to it all, which maybe only me and Bill know about. There's some real darkness there at the end of the band.
It's like a volcano, because everybody's underneath you, pushing you forward, going, come on, we want a bit of it, we want a bit of this. And eventually the thing disappears because it just reaches its peak and that's the end of it.
They just couldn't handle the music industry anymore. It was just the enemy. They just wanted to destroy it. They just wanted to stop it. They just wanted to negate it. In 1992, disaster struck. The British music industry, with the Brit Awards, nominated them for Best Band. And in true KLF fashion, they weren't going to give people what they wanted. They were going to give them what they would never forget.
It's on your own.
The KLF phoned me up and says they want us to use us as musicians. It's Hammersmith Odeon. I'd never been there before. The stage is bigger than most venues have played. We turned up in this van. Bill Drummond, he'd got a load of buckets of pig's blood in the back of it because he was going to throw it all over the audience.
I knew in my brain things were shifting, things were turning. I could feel madness pulling me in.
There was a lot of talk about sacrificing a live sheep on stage.
We'd go, right, we're going to get this sheep, we're going to chop it up on stage and throw it into the audience. Doing noise terror, we're all vegetarians, you see. Not really going to go down very well with our audience, like.
It was an act intended to be so abhorrent that no one would ever forgive them for it. One of the ideas originally was Bill chopping his hand off and throwing it into the audience. And that has echoes of the Red Hand of Ulster, of the Scottish kings going over the sea, and the one who's behind chops his hand off and throws it onto the shore, and that claims that land for that king. So it was about claiming the industry for a better power.
From London's Hammersmith Odeon, the British record industry presents The Brits 1992.
The first time ever on The Brits. After thousands of votes had been cast, we have an exact tie and two winners. Congratulations, Simply Red and the KLF.
The music industry was saying, you're the best band can possibly be. You're as good as Simply Red.
If you don't know me by now,
if you don't know me,
that's hard to deal with, I think.
And how did they deal with it?
Badly.
I've always had this rock star fantasy ever since I was young, that I'd had this massive guitar solo. I'd been rehearsing it. Hammersmith Odeon, I'm going to do my guitar solo at last. I come up to the front of the stage and go, wow. The lead gets pulled out of my guitar. I've only got 20 seconds to do the solo. I spend the whole time trying to find the end of the lead to plug back in. That was the last thing I ever did in the music business, really, trying to get my guitar plugged back in. What a lost opportunity that was, because it was a brilliant solo.
But they didn't tell me things like, they got all the pyrotechnics right behind me. Almost caught fire.
Bill was wearing this big, long leather overcoat, which has some association with Bormann and the Nazi.
I get a machine gun. Smuggle that in. I machine gun the audience with blanks and then just walk away and just go, fuck you. And that was our exit from the music business.
They didn't go and collect their Brit Award, they just sent a motorcycle courier to collect it on stage. Outside of the after party, they just dumped the sheep on the step with that I died for you.
You know, when you sat in the pub, you get drunk, you have a really stupid, crazy idea. And like the next morning you wake up and well they'd carry it through.
That's what set it apart. They basically had a different perspective because they weren't young people aspiring to get in. They were old people aspiring to get out and to break up what they were seeing.
Reconstruction of him driving around in his car at night time.
I've always hated the idea of having gold discs on the wall. I just had it on my mantelpiece and it was making me feel really sick. So I took the brick down to Stonehenge in the middle of my... And you have to be quiet, there's guards around.
He walks up towards it.
It's like You only just peel the turf back, get it in there.
He drops the Brit into a hole in the ground and covers it.
It was a symbolic way of finishing it all off for me in my head. 2 months later, somebody found it, handed it into the police. Scott was going, the police have just given me your Brit. The second time when Bill came, put it much, much deeper. And it's still there now. There was a big archaeological dig there. One of you, I was thinking, oh, it'd be great if they found the Brit.
Everybody knows that bands have a natural life. And usually, pretty early on in their career, that they make their defining record. And we both thought it should be short term. And there's also other things we wanted to do that have nothing to do with music. And music is a very jealous mistress.
He nearly stopped. Overnight. We got a phone call saying they were deleting everything, and that was it. So we sold what we had. There was no more.
No downloads, no streaming, no tours, no festival gigs, no greatest hits, no music license to video games or film soundtracks. They deliberately cut off millions of pounds of revenue.
When that catalogue was deleted, so were we, effectively. We were no longer part of the KLF story.
We've deleted it for the rest of our lives. That's what you can't get from iTunes. You can't buy CDs.
We have had all sorts of companies offering us all sorts of money, and we just say no.
It was as brutal a wiping out of their legacy as was physically possible. But they still had all this money in the bank.
Jimmy nails a wad of cash to a board with others. Voice of Jim Reed, former Observer journalist.
Initially, they'd hired me to write a catalogue for an art exhibition they were going to do.
We just had this terrible amount of cash burning a hole in our pocket. £1 million, tax paid on it, just sitting in the bank.
I assumed the identity of a guy called Anton Peck, who was a 70-year-old Viennese art critic. He was gay. I didn't know much about art, but I'd spent a lot of time being able to actually fake writing an art catalogue, I think, quite well.
They set up an art foundation, the K Foundation, which in itself is intrinsically odd because I can't think of any other band that splits up but continues to work together.
We had been going to do this exhibition called Money, a Major Body of Cash. That money was the foundation.
It's to do with controlling the money, because money tends to sort of control you if you've got it. Kind of dictates what you have to do with it, and we just wanted to be in control of it.
I thought they were doing something quite interesting, but I didn't know what it was. It involved large amounts of money on picture frames, a reserve price of half their financial value. I think one of them was like £250,000 with a reserve price of £125,000. It was going to happen in Dublin, which I was dead against. Carrying around £1 million in Ireland in the 90s was a bit iffy.
The arts establishment was not interested at all.
I'm afraid I didn't find it the sort of thing that I was either particularly interested in that I thought I would want to show in the gallery.
A field in Surrey, 23rd of November 1993.
When they couldn't get a gallery, they just held an exhibition by a motorway service station. I'd invited a bunch of press out there, and they had armoured vehicles with big K's on them, patrolling, blaring out ABBA, and a couple of burly security guards. All the journalists would be trying to steal a few notes.
A lot of people were in the NME office with money from that.
They quickly became slightly toxic in people's heads. They'd gone wrong.
Everybody was starting to get more cynical about what we were doing. So we just became outsiders immediately and riled up all the wrong people.
Voice of Lord Palumbo, Chairman, Arts Council.
Lords, ladies and gentlemen,
I start from the proposition that the artist is the most important member of society for the good and simple reason that at its best, art is the highest achievement of which the human spirit is capable. Winner of the Turner Prize is Rachel Whiteread.
Just before being picked as Best Artist of the Year with a cheque for £20,000, Rachel Whiteread learnt that she had also been singled out as Worst Artist of the Year in an alternative award funded to the tune of £40,000 by the Kay Foundation
in a concerted campaign to discredit the whole basis of the Turner Prize.
We weren't giving it to her because she was a struggling artist. We gave it to her because people had voted her as the worst artist in the country that year.
The £40,000 prize money was nailed to a picture frame and chained to the Tate Gallery.
We phoned her up and said, look, if you don't accept it, we're going to burn it.
I was basically blackmailed by the Kay Foundation to take the money, otherwise I would be letting £40,000 be burnt.
And she didn't come. And they were sort of fumbling around with matches and they were about to do it, and then she turned up.
What I decided to do was to say that I would accept the money, and then I had a statement prepared to say that I was immediately going to give the money away again.
Burning the money on the steps of the Tate would have been something. That would have hit home. If they had stuck to their guns and burned it at the exact time they said they were going to do, things would be very different.
Now, obviously, you've been in a huge, internationally successful band. The aftermath of that is quite extreme, so you're in a funny space anyway. I thought the Kay Foundation would really level me out, but in fact, it didn't. It just made me more weird.
We're just trying to maybe push things a bit further, push ourselves as far as we could go, do the best thing that we possibly could do at any given time, and just see how far we could possibly go, you know, with an idea.
There are tons of ideas that, you know, and this was over a period of about 6 months, and the central idea was about this money. The only value in society was money, and they were going to prove that. And in fact, the only value in art had become money as well.
Because the Kay Foundation, one of our little things we had written out was that, you know, we were a foundation that would go further than any other foundation would dare to go. Go the whole way and then not come back again.
We were very on the edge at that point of, I don't know what, not insanity, but in our own reality. And I remember when I went in to meet Bill in this cafe, I said, I've got this idea of something we could do with the money. I was sort of half hoping that the guy at the bar would lean over and go, no, you can't do that. But there was nobody to say no. That's what happens if you've got nobody else around you to. You end up doing really bad things.
We could have done with the money. We wanted the money. But we wanted to burn it more.
We drove to a little airstrip where we'd hired a plane. Jimmy and I knew we were going. Jim Reed knew.
And we flew up to Scotland.
They were wrapping the act in symbolism that was meaningful to them. We probably all got a place like that, where if you had to burn £1 million, it'd be the best place to do it. I know I have. What are we doing now?
What are we doing now? I've got no idea what they're going to do with it. He had the money. I was with them. For all I knew, they could have nailed it to sheep. Then we went back to the hotel, had quite a few drinks, went to bed, and then before I could get to sleep, they're banging on my door, we're going now. It was a sort of cow shed. There was no light for miles around. I don't think they were filled with dread about what they were doing to their future or their children's future. I think in the moment, it was something they probably quite enjoyed doing. I was shocked. After you get over the kind of initial, they're burning all this money, it's a bit boring. All the what have we done questions came afterwards.
15 years down the line, one of my children, they've got something wrong with them. There's only one doctor in California and it's going to cost X hundred thousand. And that's part of the thing you live with.
The band burn the money on an open fire in the cottage. In the daytime, burnt notes scatter across the grass and onto the beach. Voice of Sergeant Lachlan McLean, Isle of Jura, Scotland.
In 1994, I was working as a police officer on the island of Jura. A family were walking along the beach area when they recovered what appeared to be a substantial amount of money from the foreshore. I quickly arrived on the scene. My initial instinct was that either a light aircraft or a boat had come aground on the shore, and I eventually stumbled on Ardfin Boathouse, which was derelict at that time. As soon as I entered the building, there was a pungent smell of burning. But I was convinced that this was the seat of the fire. This is where it had originated from. I initially doubted whether or not it was legal tender. So I took the money to a bank in Beaumont on Islay, and they immediately confirmed that it was genuine. And we agreed there was no criminal offence. The legislation at that time allowed only for an offence whereby you might deface or stamp or place ink upon a note. It doesn't cover the possibility that someone might burn or destroy money, because, quite frankly, the legislative authorities wouldn't think that that would be likely.
They said to me, you can write about this if you want, but you don't have to. Obviously, I did want to write about it. I thought this is a pretty incredible event. I wrote the story, it was in The Observer, it wasn't even front page. And that was it. It had very, very little pickup in the rest of the media.
It wasn't the reaction they were expecting. How do you react to it? No one knows how to react to it. It's much easier just to turn the page and think about something else.
And I think that they were quite hungry for impact.
But it didn't get out.
No, because they'd probably had their day, you know, and I think that it wasn't spectacular.
I don't know if people didn't want to believe it. I think they suspected it was a hoax. They chose to do it in a way where they wouldn't be believed. I was the worst possible person to be there and write about it, because I had an association with them. I was working with them. If anyone was going to lie about it, it was going to be somebody like that. If they were going to hoax the world, I was the best person to do it.
To kind of make a gesture of burning the spoils of your success and no one noticing must take you to some quite dark places.
I mean, I don't know what it is, what we did. Some days I do, or bits of it. But I've never felt it was wrong. I mean, I know that I find it very hard to talk to a lot of people about it, but I don't talk to a lot of people. And I'd find it hard, you know, friends, or, you know, people, if I was to meet somebody in a pub and there's no way I could start talking to him, and, you know, if he knew who I was and done this thing or tell him about it, there's no way, you know, it'd be just, where'd you start? And, so maybe if I was...
Go on, go outside and see Mum.
You know, you want to make out that everything's fine and that it's this fantastic art statement and there's nothing wrong with it, but it's kind of riddled with flaws. The whole thing of burning the money I'm talking about. Well, just the possibility that it's just a load of rubbish and a complete waste of time. Once that comes up, and you have to sort of, you have to kind of deal with it. And it's, most of the time it's not a big deal, although you don't think about it. But if you do start thinking about it, you can get into this whole area where it's pretty, it's pretty black.
They had filmed the money burning, but on this little Hi8 camera, and the quality was awful, and they couldn't even bring themselves to watch it back for months afterwards.
No, right now I do think it's the best Ben filming that we've ever had.
It took us a year to come to terms with it. We needed a bit of time to figure out a way of presenting it to everybody else.
And we felt we owed it, at least to our families, to come up with a reason why you do something like that. You've got to be able to justify it. About a year or so later, we started showing that film at places.
So why did the K Foundation burn £1 million? There will be screenings of the film at relevant locations over the next 12 months. Each will be followed by a debate attended by Messrs. Crotty and Drummond, where the answers to the above questions and others will be sought.
Thanks for coming. We're the K Foundation, and we're going to show you our film.
It lasts about an hour. Hope you enjoy it.
They can engage people in what they've done, most of whom were very annoyed with them.
You felt physically sick watching the money being burnt, you know?
It's not irresponsible enough.
I'm not happy with seeing it because it feels like a problem. It feels like I'm trying to manipulate it.
And when we showed the film, all people wanted to know was, did you really do it? Didn't matter how much we attempted to prove that this was for real. The ones that didn't want to believe would not believe, and the ones that wanted to believe would want to believe. And the other thing everybody wanted to know was why.
Why did you burn it?
Why did you do it?
I just want to know why you did it.
You know, that's what I said. That's why we're here.
Everybody wants to know why you did it, and you can't tell them why you did it because you don't know why you did it. It's just, it's just not good enough, really.
There has got to be a better use than burning it.
I think I would rather set up some kind of recording studio for the unemployed kids or something.
Something.
Most people would be saying, why didn't you give it to charity, you bastards? What I mean is, why didn't you give it to me?
I think it's disgusting that people should be allowed to do such a thing with so much poor in this country and the foreign countries.
Us burning that money doesn't mean there's any less loaves of bread in the world, any less apples, any less anything. The only thing that's less is a pile of paper.
And they would do this in odd places. Last we tour, in Alan Moore's living room.
You were a gig. I was a gig, I was a venue. And I loved it. I really do like to see a movie where every penny of the budget is visible up there on the screen. They committed this act which undermines the concept of money. It doesn't even matter whether people have thought about it or understood it. That event has happened and things will be different afterwards.
There isn't a neat, rational explanation that you can just verbalise in a few sentences. And they were getting hated and abused.
We should have set fire to ourselves.
You've got egos that could no longer be satisfied in the music industry. And to be the first people to burn £1 million would get you into history.
You backing up to that
He shakes the man by his shoulders.
There was never a reason that was good enough. So we decided, this is not down to us, it's down to other people.
23rd of November 1995, voice of Craig McLean, journalist, Mail on Sunday.
Saturday, kind of tea time or early evening, I was at home in my flat in Edinburgh and my phone goes, and it was Bill. We want you to meet us at dawn tomorrow at Cape Wrath. Cape Wrath is the far northwest corner of Scotland, the edge of Britain, you might say. There was an MOD sign saying, do not enter. I saw the billing, Jim. They had this car, this new car, this Nissan Bluebird. And they start painting with a tin of Dulux. This, it transpires, is their contract.
They write all over the car in white paint.
Jimmy Clarty, Bill Drummond agree never to speak, write, to mention the burning of £1 million for a period of 23 years after the date of signature.
They daub this in large, messy letters. They could not and would not be stopped. When they had an idea, they were going to do it. They start pushing it towards the cliff. And I remember the photographer trying to run and photograph it going over the cliff. Silence for what seemed like an eternity. No explosion, no flames, no smoke, just crump.
The more you talk about it, the more it waters it down, dissipates it. We're going to have a moratorium for a certain amount of time, give people enough time to take on board this thing, and then they can come up with reasons why this had to be done.
That whole thing of us being conceptual artists got completely out of control. We just further on to do more and more extreme things until we ended up the lobby with the two dead cows in the back. This is at the height of the BSE thing. It must have been about 4 o'clock in the morning. We've been trying to hang them up on a pylon. They weighed a ton. We couldn't even get them out of the bag. It was just ridiculous. We didn't even know why we wanted to hang these cows off the pylon. Just hideous. It was a horrible, smelly, fucking infected mess. I said, Bill, I don't want to do this anymore. He just said, well, I don't want to do it anymore either. We just drove off in opposite directions. That was the end of it. There was no more to be done. Very symbolic, fitting end to a glorious career, really. Both driving off in opposite directions. Bill, unfortunately, with the lorry with the dead cows in the back. I don't think we even contacted each other for quite a while after that. And me and my wife, we just fled the country. Just went to live in America. Trying to get away from this monster.
They became known as guys that burnt the money. They're not known for the guys that did 3 a.m. Eternal, or What Time Is Love, or What the Fuck Is Going On. They're known as those guys that burnt the money, and that's probably pretty depressing.
It's the 1996 Brit Awards!
And when his feet move, you can see God dancing. The Brits, artist of a generation, is, of course, Michael Jackson.
Jarvis Cocker has strenuously denied allegations that he attacked Michael Jackson at last night's Brit Awards ceremony.
No return to Tory boom and bust.
Some people, they wouldn't think it was obvious enough to be art.
To us, it's no different. The stealing a Metallica CD.
As far as I'm concerned, and now I don't want to hear nothing.
If you cut down Napster today, 12 more heads will grow up in its place tomorrow.
At $93 million.
The Chancellor has said, don't panic.
So did the captain of the Titanic.
When I'm not able to pay for my mortgage, who's going to bail me out?
2010 headline, Greece runs out of money. 2013 headline, deleted KLF albums appear on iTunes and Spotify. KLF albums vanish after one day, uploads were just bootlegs.
The Fed can print money, hand it to depositors, let them hold it for a second, the panic goes away, they redeposit the money in the bank and we burn the money.
Would you like 315? On the Salvatore Mundi at 400 minutes. Sold.
BBC Breakfast, 23rd of November, 2017.
8 minutes to seven. Good morning. You might remember back in the early 1990s, the British electronic duo KLF churned out hit after hit, things like 3 AM Eternal and Justified and Ancient. But then, in 1994, they burnt £1 million in cash and disappeared. But they did promise they'd come back in 23 years' time. They're Justified and they're ancient and they like to roam the land. They're Justified and they're ancient.
At the stroke of midnight, the 23 years were up and hundreds of fans descended on Liverpool to finally discover why the KLF burnt their money.
Well, we don't know what we're doing, we don't know what's happening, but we're all here because it just means so much to play such a cool event.
But instead of giving any answers, Bill Drummond and Jimmy Courtney just brought more mystery. They'd written a baffling novel inspired by the Illuminatus trilogy. And then they were gone again, leaving the crowd to work out what it was all about. Fans had come from as far as Australia and the US for 3 days of secret events.
Would you like to sign it, please? You can keep it. That's yours.
By not talking about it, you're making everybody else talk about it. And I'm sure that it's achieved all of their intentions, even though they were working without intentions.
Money is the end between the one and the many. Money is the end between the one and the many. Money is the end between the one and the many.
I remember reading this story of how the KLF played a rave. They were DJing at the top of the scaffolding tower. At the end of their DJ set, they chucked all the money they'd made off the top of the scaffolding into the crowd. And that really got my imagination. Years later, when stuff like YouTube came up, and suddenly it wasn't just stories, you could actually go and look it up. And I looked up that on YouTube. And it was really crap. It's not special anymore. But then as that goes into history as well, the story overcomes that very bad documentation, and the story, an anecdote, is more powerful and more beautiful and, yeah, it's important again.
For me, it's just a series of things in a chain of events that I've escaped from it. But I don't really want to go back to a lot of those places, those head spaces I was in, thinking about new stuff all the time. Just people are always going, oh, when are you getting back together again? The tour, the album. Any amount of money you want. And I'm like, why were you not satisfied before? Yeah. What was it that is missing that you really still want?
But there's nothing worse to go out and perform songs or do things that you did at a different era in your life. What's great is we stopped when we wanted to stop. Jimmy and I never fell out, we still get on.
We've both mainlined all our life, we've never flirted. I don't know how to flirt. Underneath you're just surging ahead, banging away at that, mining that same seam.
Nobody ever believes me, but I never ever do it for fun. I don't even know why I do it. You keep thinking you're going to get something out of your system, and every day you hope you're going to get it out, and you can just get on with the rest of your life, but never able to get it out.
End credits. Headlines. Jimmy arrested for blaring ABBA at road protest. Bill takes small statue of Elvis to the North Pole. Jimmy produces stamps featuring the Queen in a gas mask. The Royal Mail threatened to sue. Bill shreds $20,000 painting and sells it at $1 a slice. Jimmy unveils a new artwork of riot shields. Bill announces world tour that will go on for the next 25 years. Bill and Jimmy ask for donations of funeral ashes to construct a vast pyramid tower. Hundreds apply. After this film was completed, the KLF finally released their music on streaming services. Bill and Jimmy issued a statement. The actual facts were washed down a storm drain in Brixton sometime in the late 20th century. The end.